Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear a fine talk by Nina Baker on the chemical hazards of everyday objects. Plastic bottles, tin cans, upholstery, microwave popcorn, Teflon, pans, butcher paper, dental floss, you name it. You can get the details from her book, The Body Toxic, but this talk should get you started. Baker focuses on hormone-mimicking chemicals, or endocrine system disruptors. These include perfluorinated compounds, such as PFOA and Teflon, estrogen mimics, such as bisphenol A, BPA, phthalates, and brominated flame retardants. Alas, all these hormone mimics are everywhere. Baker is a bit of an optimist, so we'll hear not only what to keep away from, but what we can do to get this ubiquitous pollution out of our environment. Speaking in Seattle in April 2010, here is Nina Baker.
Women pass on to our babies, through no fault of our own, the pollutants that pulse through our bodies. And once a woman realizes that, I think that the issue becomes magnified. These are chemicals that cross the placenta, so our babies are receiving their very first exposures in the womb. And we also know that our breast milk is contaminated with these pollutants. The presence of chemical pollutants in breast milk is very troubling, very sobering, and something that's very hard to accept. Unfortunately, bisphenol A, a chemical that is used in polycarbonate plastics like baby bottles, and the linings of food and beverage cans like that Diet Coke you may have had today or the beer that you drank last night, appears to cause some of the same effects as DES. I come from an investigative reporting background. I was in the newspaper business for about 20 years when I decided that I really wanted to write a book. And I was looking for a story that would inspire change and make a difference in people's lives. My springboard into this topic was when I heard about the work that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention was doing to measure the level of chemical pollutants in people. This is a phenomenon known as chemical body burden. And to take these measurements, researchers at the CDC are using a very rapidly advancing technology called biomonitoring. So every few years, the CDC puts out its report on the chemicals its researchers are finding in people in a representative sample of the population. And more chemicals are added to the list because our ability to measure them is growing. The latest report came out in December of 2009, so that's quite recently, and it measured 212 chemicals and chemical metabolites, which is the form of the parent chemical breaks down into inside a body in the blood and urine of a representative sample of the population. Now, I want to emphasize that there are more chemicals to be found than that to be found in people, and I would wager that all of us sitting here have more chemicals than that in our body, but that 212 number is what the most cutting-edge laboratories are able to measure for now. What got my attention about biomonitoring and chemical body burden is that these toxic body burdens are inescapable because people are exposed quite unwittingly as they go about their daily lives. And like many people, I had assumed that our regulatory system required chemicals to be tested before they were used in our everyday things. But I soon learned that the vast majority of the chemicals that make our lives so convenient have not been safety tested because it's just simply not required. And the reason is that the regulations in this case, regulations that were written in 1976, placed the interests of commerce before the interests of consumers. In fact, the Environmental Protection Agency is so hamstrung by these regulations that it's tested just 200 of more than 62,000 chemicals that were registered for use in the United States when these toxics laws were first passed. Equally astounding is this. Because of the way the regulations were written and the way the courts have interpreted the regulations, the EPA lacks the authority to ban the worst of the worst chemicals. And the best example of this is asbestos. In 1989, the EPA made a rule to ban most uses of asbestos, and because of decisions that were made in federal appeals courts based on suits that were filed by industry, most of what the EPA did was overruled. So the EPA could not ban asbestos and has not attempted to ban another chemical. That was in 1989. So I realized that that was the story that I really wanted to tell. There just seemed to be so much that was so important to the health and well-being of our society that people really weren't looking at, and this was the story that I wanted to tell. I want to give just a few examples of why, based on my research, I became so concerned about this situation. Over the past few decades, there's been a number of environmental health studies that have demonstrated how chemicals are playing some role. We don't know exactly how, but they are playing some role in the incidence and prevalence of many diseases that are on the rise. I'm talking about things like childhood cancers, such as leukemia and brain cancer, that have increased by more than 20% since 1975. Rates of asthma have tripled in the last 25 years, and asthma is now the most common childhood chronic disease. Testicular cancer, a cancer that strikes young adults in particular, is up more than 50% in the last 25 years. The risk of breast cancer affects one of every eight women. Difficulties in conceiving and maintaining a pregnancy are increasing in younger women between the ages of 18 and 25. And learning and developmental disabilities affect about one in six children under the age of 18. Chemical exposures are a contributing factor to these disturbing and costly diseases. Of course, genetics and social circumstances and behaviors contribute to these diseases, but the evidence is strong and it's getting stronger, and it's been accumulating for decades now that chemicals are a part of the mix. The chemicals that I write about in The Body Toxic are all linked through animal studies and now through a growing body of epidemiological studies to chronic conditions that impact the lives of everyday Americans. And these are chemicals that, because of their widespread use in modern society, we can't avoid. We're exposed whether we like it or not. So let's start with that diet soda or can of soup or can of beer that you consumed recently. The inside of the can is coated with an estrogen-mimicking chemical that's been in the news a lot lately called bisphenol A. Earlier this year, after a safety reevaluation that was years in the making, the FDA advised parents on how to minimize exposures to bisphenol A because of concerns about its potential to negatively impact the brain, behavior, and prostate glands of developing fetuses, infants, and children. And we know from the biomonitoring work that the CDC is doing that 9 out of 10 Americans are exposed to this chemical. That microwave popcorn snack that you munch on at work or feed to your kids, the inside of the package is coated with a grease-resistant chemical that breaks down into a highly persistent substance called perfluoroctanoic acid, or PFOA. This chemical and closely related chemicals from the same family are just incredibly persistent. It takes years for them to be eliminated from the human body, assuming, and this is an unrealistic assumption, that a person never has another exposure. We're exposed over and over and over again all the time. And epidemiological studies suggest that maternal exposures to PFCs can lower a baby's birth weight, contribute to infertility, and increase the likelihood of thyroid disease. Again, this chemical is ubiquitous. It's in 98% of the U.S. population, according to the CDC. And much of our exposure seems to be coming from food wrappers, like microwave popcorn bags and pizza boxes and bakery bags and all sorts of things that have been treated with grease-resistant coatings. The couch that you're sitting on, it's probably made with a neurotoxic flame retardant that can affect normal thyroid development. These flame retardants show up in the breast milk of American moms at rates 100 times the average of what is found in European studies. And the reason is we've just used so much more of this stuff here. And unfortunately, there's some new evidence that these flame retardants may be reducing human fertility. Vinyl flooring in your home or office likely contains phthalates, which are respiratory irritants and reproductive toxicants, especially for men. A new study done at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York demonstrated that higher prenatal exposure to phthalates are connected with all sorts of problem behaviors, disruptive type behaviors in kids between the ages of 4 and 9. And again, biomonitoring studies are showing us that humans are exposed to multiple types of phthalates at any given time. So I could go on about more commonly use chemicals than I often do, so you probably wouldn't want to go out to dinner with me. But I think you're beginning to get the picture. Every one of us has traces of toxic chemicals in our bodies, and much of it is coming from our everyday stuff. And as I mentioned earlier, these chemicals cross the placenta so that a developing baby receives his or her first exposure in the womb. In fact, I found this rather cruel and creepy, but a mom's chemical load will actually decrease during pregnancy and breastfeeding because she's essentially offloading the pollutants in her body straight into her child. Now, when these marvels of modern chemistry were discovered and then first began to be marketed 50 or 60 or 70 years ago, everyone believed that these chemicals were safe because they were used in such very small amounts. In other words, it was assumed that the dose makes the poison and that tiny amounts, we're talking parts per billion, parts per trillion, were just too small to matter. But what we've learned over the last 30 years is that these tiny, tiny amounts of certain chemicals that act like hormones can be absolutely terrible. And that's because chemicals that act like naturally occurring hormones have the ability to turn bodily systems on and off at doses as small as one part per billion or even one part per trillion, which is what naturally occurring hormones are capable of doing. And these types of chemicals, the chemicals that I write about in The Body Toxic, are known as hormone-disrupting or endocrine-disrupting chemicals. Research shows that endocrine disruptors pose the greatest risk during prenatal and early postnatal development, so really young children as well. We know that during certain windows of vulnerability, say when a brain is forming or a heart is being created or our reproductive systems are mapped out, certain chemicals can interfere. And the evidence is only getting stronger that this interference is a health threat. The Endocrine Society, which is a group of like a 100-year-old society of doctors, endocrinologists, these clinicians did something this summer that they've never done in this group's century-old history. They issued a scientific statement warning other clinicians, the medical community, and policymakers about these hormone-disrupting chemicals because of the strong evidence that exposures are linked to infertility, cancers, and birth defects. And they pointed out something else, another very important concern. These chemicals not only impact the health of an exposed individual, they also impact future generations. In my book, I talk in deep detail about the work of a professor at Washington State. Her name is Patricia Hunt. She discovered that bisphenol A disrupts early egg development in mouse fetuses. Like all mammals, and of course we're mammals, female mice form their eggs while still in their mother's womb. So not only is a fetus exposed, but so are the eggs that will produce the next generation. This is what's called a transgenerational effect. And Hunt's lab found that animals exposed to bisphenol A in utero had embryos with abnormal chromosomes. So as she explained to me, quite simply, by hitting the mother with a low dose, we increased the likelihood the grandchildren would be abnormal. So again, let's step back and think about how we're using these kinds of hormone-mimicking chemicals. They're in polycarbonate plastic, which has been used to make baby bottles and sport water bottles and the resins that line our food and beverage containers. About 6 to 7 billion pounds of BPA is manufactured every year, and some very recent information from the EPA indicates that about 1 billion pounds is released into the environment. Perfluorinated chemicals coat food wrapping papers and are used in the production of nonstick surfaces or for cookware. These chemicals are involved in the production of water repellent and grease resistant coatings like those used for Gore-Tex coats, which we really like here in the Northwest, and Stainmaster carpeting. And of course, these polybrominated flame retardants have applications for everything from furniture to televisions to mattresses to insulation to computers, car trim, carpet pads, drapes, you name it. Phthalates are found in many consumer items because they give plastic flexibility and resilience. You can find phthalates not just in PVC plastic, but also in personal care products, like lotions that you might rub on your baby. All of these hormone-disrupting chemicals are fouling our nests, and there's just no way, based on what the research is showing us, that we can shrug our shoulders and say it means nothing. So that's what got me all excited about writing a book about this topic. Once I understood the dilemma, I really wondered, where are the regulators? I'm sure you're wondering that too. Why hasn't the FDA or the EPA done something meaningful about restricting or banning endocrine disrupting substances? Well, one reason is that these chemicals produce effects that are just not predicted by the models that regulators rely on to assess toxicology. They rely on, again, this model, the dose makes the poison. And that's meaningless when we talk about endocrine disrupting chemicals that have the ability to affect our bodies at such incredibly tiny dosages. So, unfortunately, our regulatory system is based on this risk assessment model that is completely inadequate when it comes to determining what every consumer cares most about, and that is what constitutes a safe dose. It's inadequate for these types of chemicals. Since 1976, the Environmental Protection Agency has been in charge of managing chemicals in commerce through legislation known as the Toxic Substances Control Act. And the idea of this act was to regulate the worst chemicals before they got into the commercial pipeline. It's obviously a terrific idea, but because of the way the chemical industry helped write the rules to begin with, and again, the way they've protected them ever since by filing various lawsuits and sending a very expensive lobbyist to the Hill, this law has not protected consumers and continues not to do so. First of all, it gave the green light to 62,000 chemicals that were already in commerce when the act was passed. It simply presumed that they were safe, so they were grandfathered in. And second, where new chemicals are concerned, it doesn't require manufacturers to test for toxicity or measure exposure levels. In fact, the EPA for the last 34 years has been in this really impossible position of lacking the authority to request data on a chemical prior to proving it causes harm. And it can't determine harm without the data from a manufacturer. So it's this ridiculous bureaucratic catch-22 that's created this gaping informational void that's really put public health in jeopardy. And what I do in the book is really give examples of how spectacularly the Toxic Substances Control Act has fallen short in protecting public health and the environment. So I've given you a lot of bad news, but there is good news, and it's better than I could have predicted when I started working on my book. One reason I'm very hopeful is that the Obama administration's new head of the EPA, a woman named Lisa Jackson, is committed to working with Congress and the chemical industry and the public to reform the Toxic Substances Control Act so that it really does protect public health and the environment. Here's what Lisa Jackson said recently about the reason why she's made this a priority. I'm just going to read you a couple paragraphs from a speech that she gave in California. A child born in America today will grow up exposed to more chemicals than a child from any other generation in our history. A 2005 study found 287 different chemicals in the cord blood of 10 newborn babies. Chemicals from pesticides, fast food packaging, coal and gasoline emissions, and trash incineration. They were found in children in their most vulnerable stage. Our kids are getting steady infusions of industrial chemicals before we even give them solid food. Some chemicals may be risk-free at the levels we are seeing. But as more and more chemicals are found in our bodies and the environment, the public is understandably anxious and confused. Many are turning to government for assurance that chemicals have been assessed using the best available science and that unacceptable risks haven't been ignored. Right now, we are failing to get this job done. Our oversight of the 21st century chemical industry is based on the 1976 Toxic Substances Control Act. It was an important step forward at the time, part of a number of environmental wins from the 1970s. But over the years, not only has TSCA fallen behind the industry it's supposed to regulate, it's been proven an inadequate tool for providing the protection against chemical risks that the public rightfully expects. So just this week, the EPA took the first step toward regulating bisphenol A. It placed the chemical on a list of chemicals of concern, and dozens of states have moved to ban bisphenol A, including Washington. My home state of Oregon, unfortunately, was unable to get a ban through the legislature in just this year. And in all, we're seeing some very nice progress being made in many state legislatures. And with that, I think it's clear that we are in need of some comprehensive, common sense, nationwide approach to managing chemicals in our everyday things. I also want to point out that doing this, managing toxic chemicals, is not a zero-sum game. Green chemistry, it promotes the safety at the molecular level through design of benign substances to begin with. It's giving industry some really wonderful new tools to work with, and it's helping businesses make cleaner, safer products and still be profitable. One example, of course, is how the six biggest manufacturers of baby bottles have already removed bisphenol A from their products. They did this in response to consumer demand because, as I talked about tonight, our federal government is, at least at this point, not poised to reduce our exposures to this chemical. In the next few weeks, I think we'll be seeing the introduction of a bill to reform our toxics laws. It's time that chemicals should have the basic health and safety information as a condition for entering or remaining on the market, something that laws already require for drugs and pesticides. Unfortunately, the chemical industry wants to use the information that's now available, very limited information, to identify a few chemicals as priorities. And then only these priority chemicals would be subjected to further information requirements, and then only on a case-by-case basis. And it's an attempt, I think, to undermine the reforms that we so desperately need. So while the chemical industry has finally come to the table and said, okay, we agree that reforms are necessary, I think there's going to be a battle about how meaningful and substantive they are unless Congress begins to hear more and more from consumers about how important this issue is to them. I think it also makes sense that we give the EPA the ability to move quickly to reduce the impact of chemicals already known to be dangerous. These are chemicals that are very persistent or that we know disrupt the hormone system. Again, the chemical industry opposes allowing the EPA to take action on any chemicals without first undergoing new full-blown risk assessments. Well, we've been waiting for those for 34 years, and I think we'd be wasting some precious time and resources to reinvent the wheel. Chemicals, when they are assessed currently, if they're assessed at all, it's done so as if a person is exposed to just one chemical at a time in isolation. This doesn't make much sense, as the National Academies of Sciences has already pointed out. It's recommended that regulators measure exposures cumulatively, like they are in the real world. And I think this should also be considered when the EPA reviews chemicals for safety. So the European Union and Canada have already incorporated many of these changes into the way they manage chemicals used in consumer products. And without these kinds of changes, babies will continue to be born with chemicals in their bodies. And as I've talked about, many of these chemicals are suspected of contributing to a wide range of health problems from womb to tomb. We live at a time when the United States has one of the highest cancer rates in the world. More than 10% of U.S. couples are infertile. As I mentioned, one in every six children in our country has some sort of developmental disorder. This has been called the silent pandemic by two of the world's leading pediatric researchers. Obesity is epidemic among adults and children, and really some of the most unsettling information I've seen in a long time strongly links hormone-disrupting chemicals to obesity. It seems that with some people, hormone-disrupting chemicals play a role in the way that they develop and store fat. I think it makes sense that we demand well-warranted precautions based on the information that we have today. We can't really shop our way out of this problem. I can point out that there are sources and pathways of exposures, and we could take simple steps to reduce our exposures individually, and I do talk about that in the book. Even things like dusting and vacuuming regularly with a machine with a good filter helps a lot because so many of these pollutants end up in house dust. If you quit eating microwave popcorn, that's probably a very good thing. If you replace your Teflon pans with something made out of stainless steel or cast iron or enamel or hard anodized aluminum even is probably a better choice. So there are things that we can do as individuals, but I think as we move forward that if we really are going to protect the next generation, we have to make this a priority at a much bigger level, we have to demand that we do not allow hormone-mimicking chemicals into consumer products, that it's just something that we're not going to accept or tolerate. I would hazard a guess that everyone in this room has been affected in a personal way by the diseases linked through animal studies to toxic exposures. And as we move toward a healthcare model that prioritizes disease prevention, we just can't afford to ignore the plausible links between everyday toxic chemicals and our health. In 2003, the European Commission calculated the healthcare savings that would be attained by reforming European chemicals management, which was very similar to the way that we were doing it here in the United States until they undertook this reform. They figured that they could very conservatively reduce healthcare costs by 0.1% in Europe by changing the approach to toxic chemicals management. So if you applied the model used in Europe to the U.S., by reforming TSCA, we could save about $5 billion a year. We don't have to cut back any services. This is, I think, a very common sense kind of approach to coming up with savings. I think that we can demand common sense changes and safer products from the manufacturers of the things that we buy, and they do respond. We've seen that. We can tell companies that we won't buy products that contain hormone-disrupting ingredients. I think, too, as we've seen in Washington State, that we can persuade public officials to write toxics policies in our best interest and not the corporations. I think we've come to a moment that's absolutely right for all of us to call out the corporate irresponsibility and the regulatory failures and the consumer complacency that have allowed toxic chemicals to become so pervasive in our everyday lives. You know, when I was writing my book, I thought a lot about what Rachel Carson had done when she wrote Silent Spring way back in 1962. She was ridiculed and attacked and really demonized by the chemical industry, and they tried to marginalize her in so many ways. But I think readers understood that she wasn't asking or demanding that we completely ignore the potential of these manufactured substances. She was asking us to consider the costs of those substances and how we can use them more responsibly. I think that we've now come to that point with a number of chemicals that I write about in The Body Toxic. We know enough to know that we need to take precaution. And I urge all of you to think about that in your own life and in your larger life, in your public life, in your community life.
Nina Baker. For more information, check out www.thebodytoxic.com. If I may make a modest contribution, here are two principles that work for me. One, if your grandmother wouldn't recognize it, don't cook with it and don't eat it. And two, if you can buy it in glass instead of in plastic or tin, buy it in glass. Well, it's a start. Thanks to Mike McCormick and Mind Over Matters for the audio, which I have edited and condensed. And thanks to you for listening. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. To learn more, to listen online, or to send feedback, check out our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. You'll get to my non-carborundum, and ciao.